Well, friends, welcome to a new season of the Right Side Up Power Shift Edition. And this is a beautiful collaboration between World Vision and me, and it's a wonderful delight to be working with them in their work around the world. And there's going to be a lot of things we're learning here, a lot of things from World Vision workers from around the world, but also from all kinds of people who are at the intersection of power shifting. So this is from technology, the shifting power dynamics of what technology is doing. This is internal work, counseling. This is our economic systems shifting, even capitalism, the way that our politics work and the way that our businesses work. This is theological shifts of evangelism and what that looks like in these days. I mean, we are going to talk, folks. This season is fire. And we're beginning of with this beautiful power conversation I had with Dr. Sungchung Ra, and just on the dynamics of power for the church itself and the global church and the Western church and some of the way we think about power in the scriptures. And when we say Jesus is king, what we even imagine a king to be. Because not only is he a greater king, he is different from any other king. And that difference is really important. I'm not sure that there's a better topic that we can talk about right now than power and really thinking through the way that power is shifting and the way it needs to, you know, sort of celebrating a lot of these shifts, even though they bring a lot of disruption and confusion to our lives. I think we need to celebrate them and we need to uncover what they are and we need to move in the direction of God's power and what he might be doing in this season. So I am so excited. The Right Side Up, if you haven't checked out the Right Side Up season one, that's the first collaboration with World Vision and me. And it's really walking through the Beatitudes and we're asking voices from around the world who know what it means to be blessed in that way. To share with us the secrets of the kingdom and what they've been learning along the way. That still ministers to me, that season. And actually, it has become a course. So you can go to daniellestrickland.com/rightsideup, or you can go to worldvision, wvi.org/rightsideup, and you can access that season as a course with a bit of a workbook to help you through that. But this season is on power and right side up power. And I am praying that God will help us, me included, to understand how to identify my power and then also how to use and leverage my power for his kingdom come and to get myself out of the center of that. So buckle up, guys. This is the season. And we're beginning with this beautiful interview with Dr. Sungchung Ra. And I'm so privileged that you're along for this journey. Check out the show notes for all the links to all the things, but we're thrilled you're here. And I pray for us all that God would help us see this disruption in this cultural season, this era, as an invitation to partner with him for God's kingdom come. Welcome to the podcast, Doctor.
Thank you.
We're glad to have you here. And you are currently at Fuller.
Yes, I am.
But you have this incredible history of missional practice mixed with academia and some beautiful books that you've released into the world that have been really meaningful to me, by the way. Thank you so much. The Prophetic Lament is actually on my desk right now. I've been rereading some parts.
I'm very honored.
In a season I'm in. And then also The Unsettling Truths that you have. I see that in the background of your Zoom. I read that little bits at a time to tell you the truth. It's a lot. It is a lot. And it is so, so good.
Thank you so much.
Teamed up with Mark Charles. Yeah. I think it's so, so helpful. So what do you think about when you think about this idea of power shifts? What are the things that come to your mind?
Well, I think we'll have to begin with defining what is power and how is it used and how is it distributed? I think of like people power, demographic power, or power that is rooted in communities. And if you think in those terms, that power is in the people, power is among those who are in these spaces, then we're talking about a very dramatic demographic social reality shift in the world's population. Especially places like Christian communities. If you look at the a global Christian community and the growth of the church on a global scale, if you view it from like a demographic people-based power, the power should really be in the global South, in the global East, because that's where the church is flourishing, Latin America, Africa, and Asia. So if you look at power as it's where the people are, it's where the people flourish and do well, especially in the church context, then it's got to be in these communities outside of the West. However, we know that power is sometimes understood as wealth, as political power. There's a lot of different ways of understanding power. So if we see that not so much as power within the people or power within the community, but maybe an, almost an oppressive type of power, then there is a pretty radical disconnect between those who have the power and those who should have the power but are oftentimes powerless. And so that's the disconnect right now, particularly in the context of the church, where those without the power are numerically the strongest, are maybe the most flourishing in terms of church growth and church development and exciting things that are happening in the church. But those who seem to still hold the power are not necessarily in those spaces.
This is also fascinating to think about in light of how Christianity got started.
Yes.
You know, as a people power movement, instead of a political wealth top, you know, sort of empire power, it was literally started in the opposite way. So how do we even get here and how do we get out of here?
Exactly. Well, you know, Jesus was pretty clear about, I'm not trying to take over the Roman Empire. And that his kingdom is, it's both and. It's the now and the not yet. It's the present and present reality, but also the future consummation. So Jesus's teaching seems to indicate we need to be involved in both the kingdoms of this world as well as the kingdom of heaven. Our citizenship is in heaven, but we still live here on the kingdom of earth. And what we see in the early church, as you're alluding to, the early church was very much rooted in a different type of power. You know, Jesus says, you will have power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. That did not mean you will have more votes when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. You will have two more seats in the Supreme Court when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. Or you will get your candidate elected into higher office when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. That's really not a good interpretation of the biblical text. The Spirit comes and power is found among the people. And that's one of the most incredible things about the book of Acts. Power that had been in the king, power that had been in the priestly class, power that had been in the literate and the powerful and the privileged. And now the gift of the tongues of angels was found in the fisherman, was found in the person who had just encountered Christ. It was found in the person that was a tax collector. So we're talking about a power that is now found in all the spaces that were maybe held in disdain earlier. It was found among women. It was found among children. This is, again, a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, but this is an exemplar of what I think should continue. So when we go back to the early church, we see power not in, let's take over the Roman Empire. We see power in, even in our persecution, we find the power of God. Even in our suffering, we find the power of God. And you see that all throughout the early church. In fact, the growth of the church depended not on a earthly power, but really depended on a godly spiritual power. And that's definitely a narrative we've lost along the way.
Yeah, I often think, I was in a church service the other day, and it was that song, Our God is Greater, playing, which, you know, we think is true, but I was thinking through when we say things like that, like our God is more powerful, like ours is the highest of all other gods. We often have in mind that it's, you know, like Caesar, but bigger than Caesar. Mm. And we actually, I think for me, I forget that actually not only is that power greater than, but it's totally different from. Mm. So it's greater than, but different from. And if we forget that, we tend to think of God in the same power constructs and the same ways as those empire, whatever the empire is. It could be America. It could be, yes, you know, Russia. It could be Rome. But just that idea, it could be me. I'm Caesar ultimately when we get down to it. You know, I'm the throne. And so I feel like that different from maybe is this thing that we need to, that's one of the big shifts, is that this is not just greater than, it's different from.
That's very true.
Yeah. And I also wondered about this idea of power over being like a dominant view of power. And God always, and this is always fascinating to me, because he could power over, there's no question he has the capacity to, but he refuses to. He really power unders.
Yes.
Right? It's that like lifting up and liberating power, that's how he chooses to use his power. That's why it's different from. So I also was thinking about that as like images of like, we're used to power over, and God's power is under every time.
And there are so many biblical images around that, right? I mean, so for example, think about the Tower of Babel, right? The whole point of that was to tower over everybody, to show the human achievement and human accomplishment and human power and authority, to even almost equivocate human authority and power and capacity with God's power and authority. And what we see then is actually that kind of arrogance, that kind of seeking of power is judged pretty significantly and said, hey, that's not going to happen. But even think about Jerusalem. And what's interesting about Jerusalem as the capital of the promised land, as kind of the seat of power for God's people, is that it's actually not built on the physical highest space. It's surrounded by mountains. And we have that song, as the mountains surround Jerusalem. It's actually not physically higher than those mountains. It's actually physically a little bit lower. But what it demonstrates is that God doesn't have to occupy the physical highest space in order for his authority to be there, right? So God's power is evidenced not in stature, not in a kind of a political or social power. God's power is evidenced because of who he is, because it is the presence of God among the people that the power is found. I write about this in the book of Lamentations, when I write about the Lamentations, of how in the book of Lamentations, the voice of the powerful are actually kind of silenced. And we know this because the exile has occurred and the prophets, the priests, and the kings have all been sent away into exile. And we think, hey, Jeremiah, the prophet, is writing these words down. He is. But what's powerful about that moment is not that Jeremiah, the privileged prophet, speaks, but he actually shuts his mouth and wants the women, the orphans, the widows, those voices to rise up. And sometimes we forget that in the church, that in the midst of suffering, maybe we don't need those who have the power over us to speak, but we need to hear from the Spirit's power from bottom up rather than from top down. And this is one of those moments where, especially in the church in the West that's experiencing some decline, some places where we are losing members, and especially post-COVID, people aren't coming back into the church. We think the best way to get that back is by getting more power. We can, you know, have political power so that we don't have to wear masks at church, or have political power where we can act like, you know, we can do whatever we want in the public arena. Well, that's maybe not where the power is. And the growth of the church is oftentimes tied to brokenness. The growth of the church is oftentimes tied to suffering. And that's why the voices we hear maybe right now, the need is not the powerful voices, but the power that is within the grassroots, the power that comes from the widows, the orphans, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and the sick. Those voices are the voices we need to hear right now.
Wow. This is so timely in my life. You know, I've just been through a lot of stuff with the sexual abuse, clergy sexual abuse stuff happening in my local church. And just that, just even the operating in the power of God that lets the oppressed speak.
Yeah.
And then us being led by that, you know, but that is so counterintuitive, even to the church, which I think is so fascinating, because this is the scriptural witness. I mean, this is Mary's declaration of who Jesus is. I mean, this is like literally the announcement of Christ to the world. Is this way?
Yes. Exactly.
Let the victims speak. Like, let the oppressed speak. Let the women And so I, what do you think, like, what is your best practice for this? Like in your own life, and when you're talking to churches or even organizations and structures and systems, like, how do we really, operate in a power that's different from.
Yeah. Well, Danielle, let me say up front, the people of God should never apologize or walk back away from speaking on behalf of the oppressed and the marginalized. Mm-hmm. I think we forget that that's what the prophets did. And I think that's, we forget that's what Jesus did. That is the role of the church. And in some very sad ways, we've relinquished that role. We are to speak on behalf of the oppressed, the marginalized, the persecuted, the suffering. And if we don't do that, we're not fulfilling our calling as prophets, as priests, as the church. And so I don't think any of us should ever apologize to say our work is absolutely to defend the poor, the oppressed, the fatherless. That's our job as a church, and we need to keep at that. For me, it's been really important for me to hear the voices in my life that are not the powerful. Now, I will admit that I've gained power as an Asian male. The way I've gained power is through my degrees. I go to the schools and I collect my master's degrees and my doctorate degrees, and I get the faculty positions that I want. And those are the kind of things that give me a particular power. It gives me a particular position and an authority as a learned person, someone with all the letters after his name. But what I've really had to learn is, how do I understand true power that comes from the power of God rather than the power of my own achievements? And the two places that I found that, one is, just like many of us, the story of our parents. In my case, particularly, the story of my mom. My mom passed away about a year and a half ago, and I feel that spiritual loss. She died when she was 88, and she was such an incredible prayer warrior. And then I compare her life as a single mom, immigrant, didn't speak much English. She worked blue-collar jobs, service industry jobs. We were a family on food stamps because, you know, we were a poor family, a single mom family. And the powers that be during that time called my mom a welfare queen, called my mom someone who kind of cheated the government for food stamps. That's not the case at all. She was a hardworking woman who kept four children and raised them up to be God-fearing and loving people. But what I remember most about her is that she didn't have a social political power. She was an immigrant. She was a single mom. She was a service industry person that didn't speak much English. She didn't have any of that social political power, but she had incredible spiritual power. Mm-hmm. I tell this story quite often that in her 60s, she showed me the condition of her knees and showed that she not only had, she didn't have one kneecap on each knee, she had five, because she was such a prayer warrior. She would kneel before God every day for an hour or two at a time, praying for her children, praying for her grandchildren, that her kneecap split open and conform now to the shape of the floor. Wow. And that kind of power, I forget when I was getting my degrees from Harvard and Duke, I kind of forgot that that's real power. Mm-hmm. To be a 67-year-old woman on her knees praying every day and to change her family because of her prayers. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of power that we've lost in the church. And so for me, the really important discipline is to go back to that kind of faith. That kind of faith that is not rooted in my accomplishments or in my achievements, but to say, here is a woman that just on her knees exhibited incredible spiritual power. Actually, the kind of power I'm not sure that I could access, but I've seen it. And that's the kind of power I want to see, the power of a woman praying on her knees for her children and her grandchildren and the effectiveness of those prayers.
Mm, that's beautiful. I mean, I think even, I think, yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for sharing that. It's beautiful and tender, and I'm sorry you lost her. And although she's still interceding for you, who's kidding who?
That's right.
But I think even what you've said is really strategic here, because what you're doing is you're changing your aim. Yeah. And I think this for me too, I think I've come, you know, by the grace of God to keep reminding myself in the midst of all the access to privilege and power that I do have to realize that that's not the power I want.
Yes.
That's not the power I need. Like, can I have it? Sure. Do I have it? Yes. But do I want it? Do I need it? Absolutely not. Because the power I really want and the power I really need is the power of God. And that, you know, that picture of your mom on her knees accessing and then actually being a conduit of that power in your life. And yes. I guess that's number one, is like, what are you aiming for? And that might be whether it's an organization listening or an individual person listening to this podcast or a church leader listening to this podcast, you know, a nonprofit person, like, change your aim.
Yeah.
That's not a bad beginning. Like, what are you aiming for? What is it that you are desiring? Because that's going to matter in terms of what you do, what you spend resources on, who you yes. listen to. What kind of power is it that you want?
that's the kind of understanding of power that, exactly right, it points us in a different direction. So if our goal is not kind of a self-aggrandizing, self-perpetuating, self-elevating, hey, our church has to be the biggest, or mm-hmm. our denomination has to be the strongest, or we have to be the most pure, church with the purest doctrine, and all the kind of language that we have around church growth and church development and church flourishing, it tends to be extraordinarily self-centered. We're a successful church if we have a really nice building. We're a successful church if we have X number of people on Sunday. Those feel like a really kind of an inadequate aim for me. I don't want to give my life so that my church can grow from 50 to 500. That doesn't feel like something that actually changes the world. It might change my church, and we might have more offering, and we might have, you know, a lot of fun together. But at the end of the day, my aim is to fulfill the kingdom of God in this generation, to fulfill the work and will of God in this generation. And that's where I think the more we spend time with those that are not in places of power, but in places of weakness and brokenness, like my moms of the world, the single parents of the world, the immigrant grandmothers of the world, the more we spend time in those communities, the more our sight lines are adjusted, because we see what's going on immediately around us. We see the pain, we see the suffering, and we realize this aim of self-growth and self-development and, you know, hey, our church is going to be big, our church is going to be the best. That just feels so shallow. And that actually changes our trajectory. I'll tell another story. I taught for 3.5 years at Stateville Correctional Center, and it was absolutely life-changing. And I remember walking in with a pretty clear agenda about what I wanted to do. I mean, I was the Ivy League educated, I'm the tenured professor. I'm going to walk in with my syllabus and my books. I'm going to impress all these hardened criminals. That was my idea. And of course, I get there and I realize, boy, this is a different world than I thought it was going to be. First of all, I'm a relatively short guy. So I'm walking into that classroom trying to assert my authority, and everybody's like 10 inches taller than me and, you know, much more cut than I am. And so I'm feeling kind of small. And so I thought, hey, the best way to do this is to assert my adequacy more, assert my, you know, draw more power to myself, draw more authority and really assert that. But what I found in that space was incredible grace that I did not encounter anywhere else. I was going through a very difficult time in the time that I was teaching at Stateville. Kind of everything in my world was falling apart. And as much as I tried to keep it together, I couldn't do it. And I actually broke down in the classroom one time. And I remember the incredible grace with which these men with 15 to 45 year life sentences hanging over them, and this arrogant little short Asian guy comes into their midst, and instead of rejecting me, they completely embraced me. One of my dear brothers actually came over as I was kind of breaking down. He whispers in my ear, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but you really need this. And he just gave me a bear hug. And, you know, prisoners and visitors are not allowed to touch, but he was willing to take that risk to comfort me and to be the presence of God for me. That changes your idea of power. Because to be honest, I did have the power. I was a free man. I was a tenured professor. I've got my Ivy League degrees. I did have all the power in that room from the worldly perspective. But we shift our aim and we shift our social context. And we say the real power was in that hug that came from a person who had a life sentence and may never get out. But in that moment, his spiritual power was what really saved me. And if we have that kind of experience, it changes us. And so, you know, I'm one of the staunchest advocates for prison reform. We have got to change our prison system. We've got to change how we do this. We've got to change the racial dynamic that leads to the mass incarceration of Black bodies at a much higher rate. And I don't do this just because of the numbers. The numbers are clearly there. I do this because I was in a community where love, grace, power, mercy, all of that was handled so differently that it changed me. And my aim, my trajectory, how I understood the world was transformed by that. Those are the kinds of powerful transitions, transformation that we need in the church right now. Not let's gain more power so we can exhibit more power, but let's be in places that challenges us to oftentimes be powerless. And does that actually change our hermeneutic, change our lenses, and change our trajectory?
That's beautiful. What a beautiful story, first of all, but also just this idea that one, the inadequacy of the power that we hold is revealed in that proximity place, right? Like in proximity with real oppression, the power of this world cannot touch it. That's the trouble. You know, and I've had that over and over and over again, where you could have all the resources in the world and it not touch the kind of oppression that needs to be broken by a different kind of power. Yes. So it creates like this, like, this power is not going to work. Like a Harvard degree is not going to be enough to change a prisoner's heart. then to change your heart either. Right. Yeah. But there is a power, and to see that power and the way that power works. So so basically it's proximity.
Yeah.
You cannot get this without proximity. I wish you could learn this from a textbook.
Right. Me too. Cause that's what I teach. I teach textbooks. And it was interesting, the both and for me. One side of it was being in that kind of place and, you know, in some sense, forced to be powerless for the first time, right? So, you know, I come from a broken home. I grew up in the hood, but, you know, I worked my way up to become a tenured professor. I worked hard to get my degrees. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you kind of cling to that earthly power that you've accomplished. You know, some of us have worked our way to be a senior pastor. We've worked our way to be president of institutions and organizations. We've worked our way up. And so we cling to how we got there. What got us there is a little bit of our pride, maybe a little bit of our assertiveness and all those things that got us there. We think that's what's going to be what's good. And so that's what I brought into the classroom in Stateville, but that's not what worked. So learning my powerlessness was an important part of it. But the other part of it for me was also, at the same time, I've got to recognize I do have a power and privilege. And I've got to turn that power and privilege not inward towards myself so that I might be, you know, something special, but I've got to turn my power and privilege towards these dear friends who are now close to me, who are now my brothers in Christ. And so how do I advocate for them in the court system? How do I advocate for parole to be instituted in Illinois? Because Illinois is one of the few states without a parole system, which means that someone who might have been unjustly put a 45-year life sentence on has no opportunity for parole. And so how do I advocate in the legal system as someone with a certain degree of power and privilege, as a voting citizen? How do I begin to advocate for that? How do I speak in churches, even if that's unpopular? You know, it's not popular to talk about the incarcerated. It's not popular to talk about those who might have committed crimes and you might say, hey, it's right for them to be in jail. But I have a power. I have a privilege of being able to write, being able to teach, being able to speak at churches. And I can't put that aside. I've been changed enough to say I've got to use that power and privilege, not for my own sake, but for the sake of these dear brothers who are walking along the journey with me.
Mm. Wow. What's that power for, huh?
Yes. Yes.
And that's good. You're sharing that from your own individual source of power, but the same could be applied to organizations, to nonprofits, to structures, to systems, to churches. Yes. What is this power for? And if you just spend it and use it for yourself, that's a totally different kind of power.
Exactly.
Wow.
My background is my doctorate is in history, and particularly around the history of evangelicalism. And it's interesting how evangelicalism, the trajectory, especially of U.S. evangelicalism, was one of power, right? It starts off as kind of a marginalized group, as almost, you know, kind of backwater, you know, hey, these are the uneducated folks. And then gradually, particularly in the 1970s forward, you see evangelicals gain more and more power, and then also more and more followers, more and more success. Mega churches start springing up. Evangelicals are political leaders, social leaders. And in some sense, that kind of success actually might have been a part of evangelicalism's demise, because that kind of success led to arrogance, led to more wanting more power, wanting more of that position in society. And we might have forgotten what it actually means to be on the outside looking in. What it might be on the for those who are marginalized from that power. And we have a very different way of understanding the world. And, you know, as a movement, as a larger American church, there are so many gaps because we were so intent on becoming so successful, and especially following kind of capitalistic models of growth and success, that we really lost so much of what it means to actually be the church. Yeah. And that gap is now, I think, ultimately going to lead to our demise.
Yeah. And the answer, maybe part of the answer might lie in one, recognizing your actual spiritual powerlessness, and then yes, getting proximate to folks who have a different kind of power.
Exactly.
Which again, this will lead us to, I mean, the good news about, and I always say this to people, the good news about the church is, as much as the Western church is failing, the global church is thriving.
Yes.
So don't worry. Like, we're going to be fine. The global church will lead us. Yes. What's going to, we just have to really change our posture, shift our language, start learning instead of teaching. You know, like, yes, I often feel the audacity of a failing church to teach church growth to a global thriving church is fascinating to me.
Yes.
I'm just like, wow, you guys think really highly of yourself, but I hate to tell you, it's not working.
Yes. Yes.
But maybe you should ask what is working, you know?
Exactly. And this is where I really feel, and this is what I wrote about. We need to rediscover some spiritual practices that we have kind of put to the wayside because of our pursuit of success and triumph and victory. Mm-hmm. And that's what I write about in Lament. Mm-hmm. How did we lose this really central, incredible, powerful spiritual discipline and spiritual practice? What I write about in my book is that overwhelmingly in our church worship life in the U.S., and North America and Europe is also similar to this, you overwhelmingly emphasize triumphant, victorious worship songs or hymns. And you read the triumphant, victorious psalms, but you ignore the lament psalms, even though of the 150 psalms, 60% are celebratory and 40% are lament. We read 90% of the hymns that are celebratory, and every once in a while, maybe during Lent, we'll read one or two psalms of lament. And so there's a disconnect from that spiritual practice. Again, profoundly evident in the scriptures, not just the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament. Jesus practiced lament over and over again. The prophets practiced lament over and over again. But we in the West, and particularly in the North American church, we've lost that power of lament. And so because of that, we can't see how God is present in suffering. And so we want to say, okay, in the midst of COVID, this isn't really God at work. We're just waiting so we can get back in person and worship together. That will really be God at work. But you know, in the midst of pain, that's not really God at work. In the midst of prison, that's not God at work. In the midst of the decline of the church, that's not God at work. When we get back to being a big church and everybody's there and we fill our parking lots and our offerings are back up, that's when God will really be at work. And because we don't lament, we don't see God in the midst of suffering and pain. Yeah. And the global church is teaching us that. Some of the most significant revivals in the 20th and 21st century have been by the suffering and persecuted church. It is out of that suffering and persecution that revival often occurs. It is out of the lament of that brokenness in these churches that revival and the move of God occurs. And unfortunately, in the West, we are so unfamiliar with suffering. We have no idea what to do with suffering. We don't know how to lament. I don't know how revival comes without lament. I don't know how revival comes without recognizing pain and suffering in the world.
I mean, that's what kicked off the Exodus, right?
That's right. That's right.
Lament.
That's right.
I've the God who hears the cry.
That's right. And over in the Psalms.
Yeah. I'm just releasing a book at the end of August called The Other Side of Hope. And one of the, and your book has been helpful to me in this, because I think one of the mistakes we've made about hope is we equate hope with happiness. And so we don't realize, and this is, I think we confuse sorrow for despair. So we avoid it at all costs. So we put on a hopeful face, we put on a hopeful posture, because we think sorrow is despair, but sorrow is actually the place where hope, true hope, authentic hope is found. And so we avoid sorrow for hope, but then what we have is a fake hope. It's not authentic or real.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, even in my life, that's been a path. Like, cause when I actually thought, I just tell half of the book is me just telling stories of where I saw this glimpses of like fleeting hope in like these crazy circumstances and from people I never expected it. And so for me, as I was just even thinking about like, where do I get my, you know, certain hope from? Like, where do I, through tough times, where do I know that like, that's, God's with us. Like, it's okay. Like God's got us. Like God's going to get us no matter what, you know, we're held by God. And it's like, oh, I get it from these people who are no sorrow. And out of those horrific places of sorrow and grief and suffering and pain and oppression have discovered a hope that's so much deeper, so much better.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
I think there's oftentimes a confusion from some of these terms, right? So for example, joy and happiness, we think happiness is joy. Right. Because happiness makes us feel good about ourselves and about each other, right? And that's our goal, to be happy. But joy doesn't preclude lament and sorrow. And that's what's so powerful about joy. Joy can be found in the midst of suffering. Joy can be found in the midst of pain. And I think in kind of, again, Western culture, we're so seeking that self-satisfaction, that sense of being happy or feeling good, that we sometimes forget that there's a deeper feeling of joy. And that's the other side. Joy includes hope. Happiness doesn't necessarily need hope. Right. Joy includes sorrow. Happiness precludes sorrow. So these are places where I think our terminology and our understanding the depth of theology, for example, is really kind of inadequate to say our goal of the church is to make people feel happy. I'm not sure that's true, but that's the goal of a lot of churches. The goal of the church is to make people feel joy. And sometimes joy requires lament. Joy requires sorrow and suffering, because true joy, the deep joy that comes from acknowledging the reality of sorrow and suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and God's presence in the midst of it all. So it strikes me, it strikes me that prophetic lament is this beautiful biblical deep dive into this tool that will help us. And just for the record, if folks here have not gotten that book, get that book and read that book. Cause I actually think what you're offering is a tool for right now. Like when churches talk to me about what we're going to do in this moment, I'm like, the church is designed for this moment because we're the only people who have this tool called lament. And this is really almost the only thing we can do right now. So no one else really knows how to do that, but we do. And so we could lead this moment, this cultural moment in lament. That's the very least we could do for this cultural moment.
Yeah.
So grab that book. So it's fantastic. Just biblical. Of course you're a biblical teacher, scholar. So it's filled with that stuff, but I think it's so pivotal to right now. And then it strikes me that the next book you wrote with Mark Charles is this, like, let me show you how to take in sort of this, you know, deep pain and injustice and realities and truth, right? And actually apply all of these biblical principles of lament in response.
Yes.
Is that fair?
You actually got the origin story of that book, by the way. That's actually how that happened. So Mark and I have been friends for years and years. And one of the ways we connected, because we live in different parts of the country, is we would go to conferences and we would speak together. And, you know, oftentimes we would end up speaking back to back. And that was kind of cool because we would, you know, and so we would go to all these different conferences, denominational gatherings, and speak together. And then after about three or four times that happened, we were speaking back to back, said, I think we're talking about the same thing here, because Mark was talking about the doctrine of discovery and it's the impact, especially on Native communities. And I was talking about lament and the need for lament. And we realized, hey, this is actually the same thing, that the reality, historical social reality, particularly the suffering of the Native communities as a result of this warped theological imagination, that really requires lament. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's how our book came together. We actually started doing workshops together on this particular topic and work side by side. We still do workshops on this topic because we realize that the need for lament, and the way I define lament is the appropriate spiritual, ecclesial, liturgical response to the reality of pain and suffering in the world. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't do the response because we don't know the reality of pain and suffering in the world. So Unsettling Truth was
trying to refuse. If we continue to refuse the reality of pain and suffering in the world.
Yes.
And that's because we don't know what to do with it. So that's exactly why these two things have to go together.
Yes.
And this is our impulse, is to be like, shove it away, shove it away, shove it away.
Right.
Because we have no tools to actually deal with the truth. But
yes,
the tool to deal with the truth is lament.
Exactly.
So these things go together big time.
And that's the both and. And you're hitting right on the head. It's the need for lament, but what are you lamenting? And then once you know what you're lamenting, do you know how to lament? And both of those tools are missing in our society right now, sadly.
Yes.
But I absolutely 100% agree with you. That could be one of the most significant contributions of the church. Mm-hmm. And it was in other cultural contexts, by the way. It was in Korea. It has been in Africa. It has been in Latin America, where the church's appropriate response of lament, advocating for those that are suffering, advocating for those that are in pain, crying out to God on behalf of those that are in pain, that was what transformed the church in many of these spaces. Mm-hmm. And so here we are right now in the midst of some deep, deep pain, sorrow. And there's a long history to that too. That's the part I think we need to get down to, which is the Native community is suffering not because something they did a year ago, but because of things that happened hundreds of years ago. And we can't deny that. The African-American community is suffering not because of something that happened 2 weeks ago, but because of centuries of persecution and suffering. And so we have to know those truths, unsettling truths, in order to lead us into lament. But once we get to that place, we also have to lament. And that's where the balance is. Speak the truth in love, but then also offer to the world, offer to those that are suffering, hey, here is a way forward, the way of lament. And this, that's very spiritual. You know, the government will never lament. Your local politician will never lament. Your school systems aren't going to lament. But this is where the church can play that powerful spiritual role of offering spiritual language of lament that responds to the suffering in the world.
Well, and this is a pretty good measure. When your government's doing a better job at lamenting than the church, you know you're operating in the wrong power.
That's very true.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. This has been incredible. Thank you so much. I've learned so much. What are some other next steps? Or I know obviously your books are really helpful, and the book you wrote with Mark Charles, great, fantastic. And everybody, if you don't know Mark Charles, you really should go to Facebook. You can watch the sunrise with him sometimes in the morning and listen to his devotions. He's a wonderful, wonderful voice of truth in the world. And I'm so glad you guys teamed up. You're both, what a dynamic duo for such a time as this. Super thankful for you. What are other ways people can track with you and find out what you're up to and maybe support some of what you're doing?
Sure. I'm on Facebook and Twitter at Prof Ra. I do have Instagram, but I only post pictures of my kids. That's kind of the extent of my Instagram. I don't see anything profound on Instagram. I'm not really a big social media person, but the books are one of the best ways to access. I teach now at Fuller. So if any of you are interested in taking an online class with me at Fuller, that's a great way to be introduced to seminary education. I do travel and speak, and so you can follow me there as well. But I really appreciate those who explore these ideas and look for ways to continue to discuss these ideas. And so that could be done via social media with me, but also just kind of going out and take a look at some of my books and like a lot of podcasts and YouTube clips as well.
I Googled you. And so this is good news, people. When you Google Sungcha Ra, you will find all kinds of things, including I've been watching videos, free videos from Fuller on some teachings that you've done. They were fantastic. I love them. So shout out to Fuller. Thank you. And there's even more, I'm sure, that you could discover. Thank you so much for what you're doing in the world and for writing about it and speaking about it. And I guess also just using your power so well. Thanks for being such a good example.
Thank you, Danielle. Also for your good work and your faithfulness. Thank you.
Thanks. Hey, I'm not sure that I've mentioned The Creative Way Down in some time, but The Creative Way Down is a 3-month deep dive, a course in depth. It uses the Beatitudes and it features Aaron White, who's one of my great, good, beloved friends and also one of the wisest. And by wise, I don't just mean smart, although he's that. I mean also lived experience and lives out what it is that he knows, which is kind of the definition of wisdom. He instructs us in the Beatitudes as a way into a deeper way of participating with the life of Christ. And it is deep, beautiful. There's a really in-depth manual that has like early morning, midday, and evening exercises and prayers. There's playlists associated with it. There is a podcast where Aaron and I just discuss every single video, every single lesson. There's a lot. And so if you wanted something to do with some friends or even with one person, we do recommend doing it together with somebody where you want to say, you know what, I really want to focus in on surrender, or I really want to focus in on generosity, or I really want to focus in on mission or others. Those are the lenses the Beatitudes are in. And it is a robust, beautifully practical, deep way of entering into the creative way down. So go to infinitumlife.com and you'll see the creative way down there and check those out. Those are available for anybody at any time. And it is a phenomenal resource.